morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial in Portland, 91.9 in Columbia Gorge, and 100.7 in Willamette Valley. This is More Talk Radio with Cecil and Celeste, although Celeste is not here today, so this is More Talk Radio with Cecil, and we'll introduce our guests in a moment. Today is Monday, June 20-something, and it's supposed to be a warm day. But we have a couple of announcements to share with you before we get into our program. On Sunday, July 2nd, Books to Prisoners will host an all-ages benefit film showing and prisoners letter-writing party for from 4 to 8 p.m. at the Red and Black Cafe, which is located at 2138 Southeast Division Street. Come learn more about North American political prisoners from 4 to 6 p.m. and write a letter or birthday card to one of them. Then watch and discuss USA Incarcerated, a film produced by Critical Resistance about the rise of the prison-industrial complex in the U.S. and the trade-offs that are being made to support this growth. Following the movie, Therapeutic Music will host a guerrilla poetry showcase featuring words and beats by Open Mind Head Therapist, Children Born of Water, and Eric Beats. A donation of $6 or a dictionary is requested. All proceeds go to Portland Books to Prisoners and Books to Oregon Prisoners. For more information, you may email them at getreadybookstopprisoners@riseup.net. That's pdxbookstopprisoners@riseup.net, or you may visit them on the website, which is bookstooregonprisoners.org. Now, of course, if you were unable to get all that information down, you may call the front desk after 9 a.m., and they will read it to you slowly. And so the announcement will be at the front desk if you would like more information. If you have news or information to share with us, please drop us a line here. We may try to get it on the community calendar or announce it during the program. Our address here is 20 Southeast 8, that is in Portland, and we welcome news and information about the communities and things that are happening. This morning, we'll have the wonderful opportunity to talk with Victor Novasky, who now, what's your grand title? Editor Emeritus?
Well, I'm Publisher Emeritus of The Nation and Chairman of the Columbia Journalism Review.
Okay.
After editing The Nation for all those years.
Victor will be with us this hour to talk about a book he's written, a memoir, A Matter of Opinion. And also he will be speaking this evening, and we'll share that announcement later on in the program. But certainly we invite you to listen in, and later on we invite you to call in. Our call-in numbers are 503-231-8187. Again, our numbers are 503-231-8187, and join us in the conversation with Victor Novasky. It's really a fascinating volume that we have here, and it's a pleasure to welcome you. Thank you.
Good to be here. Thank you, Cecil.
Have you been to Portland before?
I certainly have. I came and read A Matter of Opinion at your great bookstore. Now I've been through a number of times. I've spoken at Reed College. Mm-hmm. I have friends here, and I always look forward to it.
Well, this is great.
And I've been to this station before.
This station, okay.
Okay.
So you know Reed College, you know Powell's Bookstore, you know good people, and
yes.
Cable. So welcome back home.
Well, it's good to be here. I feel at home here.
Oh, great. Now tell me, was this week singularly barren of exciting events?
Okay. What you've done is you have stolen, plagiarized, and memorized the best, for my money, the most courageous sentence ever to launch a magazine in the history of magazines, which was on July 6, 1865, the first sentence in the first issue, in the first story on the first page of The Nation magazine, was, "The week was singularly barren of exciting events, of significant events." And to me, to say that in the launch of a new magazine says a great deal about the magazine. Because first of all, what it says is we're not going to indulge in false hype. We're not going to sensationalize the news. We're not going to pretend that there's a story there when it isn't there. And you can trust us. And boring though it may be sometimes, it's going to be real. So that's a very important sentence that you opened with. My other, by the way, favorite sentence in The Nation is, in the nation's history, is a sentence that William Lloyd Garrison, the great abolitionist, was known for. He was the editor of The Liberator magazine, which went out of business when the Civil War was over because they had succeeded in their abolitionist goal. And he turned over their subscription list to The Nation. And his sentence was, "I will not equivocate, I will not excuse, I will not retreat a single inch." And to me, you know, you put those two sentiments together, this idea that they would crusade on behalf of the dispossessed, of what they, of justice, of what they knew to be right, zealously, week in, week out, with the other one, that just no hype, tell the truth. And at its best, that's what The Nation has been all these years.
Now perhaps we should go back and explain something about what is The Nation, terms of its origins.
Okay, so The Nation is a weekly magazine. It is printed on butcher paper. Mm-hmm. Calvin Trillin, our staff humorist, once said on The Tonight Show that it's the only magazine that looks better, the Xerox copy looks better than the original, although now its editor, Katrina Vanderhul, has fancied it up, and we have some beautiful art in there. We even run photographs, and we have some of the greatest cartoonists in America who contribute to us. But it's a, it was founded by people in and around the abolitionist movement, but it has been a consistent voice challenging the conventional wisdom, questioning the official line, and yet upholding a vision of what the world could be like and attempting to build for a better future. So I, one of the things our European correspondent, Daniel Singer, the late Daniel Singer, used to say was, be realistic, ask for the impossible. And I like to think that's what The Nation does sometimes. Mm-hmm. And its contributors down through the years have ranged from an unknown preacher down south who used to do an annual civil rights audit called Martin Luther King, who came to fame. Mm-hmm. It was the first to publish Ralph Nader when he was a student at the Harvard Law School. He wrote an article about unsafe cars that became a book and started at the public interest movement. Early on, its investors, right after it was founded in 1865, complained to the editor that he was wasting space because he ran an article called A Day at the Races in Saratoga, and the article turned out to be by an unknown journalist named Henry James, who mm-hmm. went on to write 250 pieces for the magazine. So it's got an extraordinary and glorious history. And during the Cold War years, by the way, the domestic Cold War, it was the first to take on the late Fred Cook, who was a great mm-hmm. muckraker, the CIA and the FBI, when they were sacred cows and nobody wrote about them in those days. The Nation devoted entire issues to both of those organizations. And I was privileged to go to work there as the editor in 1978.
Mm-hmm. the nation has such a long, illustrious history. It's almost, in some circles, it's seen as some sort of icon. What I found fascinating in your book, A Matter of Opinion, was that you not only talk about how a magazine works, but sometimes some of us have this romantic view of writers. You sit there and you write what you want, and somehow you find a beautiful magazine and you publish it, and things are fine. What I discovered in reading your book was how much work it takes just in terms of making sure a magazine is published, and the amount of times, you know, in terms of meetings to get financial backers, and that was it was quite an eye-opener for me.
I spent, even when I was editing the magazine, which was from 78 through 64, well, I stopped editing it really. I was the editor-in-chief from 78 through 65, then I became the publisher and editorial director. But even when I was just called the editor, I would help raise money for it, because the magazine was always a little short of funds. And, you know, I mentioned Calvin Drillin before. He's the house humorist, and he used to go around saying that we pay in the high two figures. And they would get a lot of laughs, but... what he didn't say was it was my line, and I told him we were thinking of paying him in the high two figures. Mm-hmm. We had very little money at the time. Actually, we paid him in the low three figures, $100 a week, not a penny more and not a penny less. But we did put together a remarkable group of shareholders in the magazine, and we have a handful of larger investors, but the really exciting thing is we have a circle of 100 small shareholders, and that's part of life at a small radio station and at a small magazine. On the other hand, it is your first point. It is really working with writers and working with your colleagues to get it out every week that consumes your time. And funny part is people have this image of a magazine like The Nation and Journals of Opinion as a class, as they talk of us as preaching to the choir. Yeah. And they say, you know, you're preaching to the converted, so what difference does it make? And, of course, anyone who reads our letters page would see we have the least harmonious choir in choral history, that it's, everyone is always debating with everyone else. And it's just that the debates are different from the ones you get in the mainstream media, that our writers will debate. Our feminist, radical feminist writers believe that pornography ought to be banned, and our civil libertarian writers believe that, or readers, that nothing ought to be banned. So there's a debate. You don't get that kind of debate in the mainstream media. Or a debate between human rights activists who do believe in going into other countries and in genocidal situations, versus our pacifist readers who believe that you never use force of arms in any situation. And that's a very different kind of debate than you get in the mainstream media. So it's a special experience to preside over and be part of such a conversation.
We're speaking this morning with Victor Novasky, the author of A Matter of Opinion, past editor, publisher of The Nation magazine.
Yes.
142 years,
right?
Wow. And Victor will speak this evening at the Multnomah Athletic Club, sponsored by the Portland World Affairs Council, 1849 Southwest Salmon in Portland, for members, the tickets are $5, non-members $10. RSVP for reservations is required, and we'll share more about that later on. In opening your book, I was fascinated that you went to college. You're the first.
I went to Swarthmore and you went to Haverford.
Okay, good. Let's hear it for,
that's like good, Harvard good and Yale on a Quaker level.
On a Quaker level, yeah.
Right.
used to play football until the Quakers said football was too violent, I guess.
Well, at Swarthmore, they don't play football anymore.
Yeah, not that to have a foot. But anyway, getting back to your life and this book here, one thing that you went to college, and then you didn't go to journalism school. You went to law school. Tell us about that.
Okay. So I went to the Army first. And that was, I got out in 1954, the tail end of the Korean War. It was officially over, but no one really knew whether it was really over. And, the draft was still on, and, you got the GI Bill, though. And, I went into the Army and, just taking a detour from my life as a journalist, we were talking about our Quaker, colleges. I remember in basic training, the day they taught us how to use a bayonet, and the sergeant gave this big speech, and he said, first you fix the bayonet, and he showed us how to do that, then he said, then you charge down the field about 50 yards, there's a dummy there, and it gets your adrenaline up, so you run at top speed, you point your bayonet at the dummy, and then you plunge it into the dummy and you yell as you charge it down the field, kill, 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 and you twist the bayonet into the dummy. And then he paused and he said, now, some of your mothers have complained to their congressmen that their sons are being required to yell, kill, 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 and the congressmen have called the commander of the base. Those of you whose mommies don't want you to yell, kill, 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 are allowed to yell, lollipop, he said. So my friend Huey Thurswell and I, he was a graduate of the University of Chicago Law School, went running down the field yelling, lollipop, lollipop, lollipop. Mm-hmm. And so that was my military experience. I got the GI Bill. I put out a newspaper in the Army, by the way, but I got the GI Bill, although when I say I put out a newspaper, I was the editor of the 53rd Infantry News in Alaska, and it was called Troop Information and Education rather than journalism, and I think that's what it should be called. Bob Sherrill, who writes for The Nation, once wrote a book called Military Justice is to Justice as Military Music is to Music, and I think of military journalism the same way. Wow. And after I got out of the Army with my GI Bill, I went to the Yale Law School. And I thought that since I had 3 or 4 years of free education, the world could wait 3 or 4 years to hear what I had to say as a writer, especially since I didn't have that much to say. And I was very glad to have the opportunity to go there. And while I was there, two things happened. One is I started a magazine of political satire called Monocle. Our motto was, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king, and we called ourselves a leisurely quarterly of political satire, which meant that we came out twice a year. We made trouble, and actually after the first issue came out, I got a pink slip from the postmaster, and we thought, and I went down to the post office on command with law books quoting Justices Black and Douglas and Chief Justice Warren, because we thought we had published stuff that was, we were going to be accused of being of seditious libel or something. Instead, we had erroneously listed ourselves as second-class matter, which I thought all magazines automatically were, and the postmaster tactlessly explained that we were fourth-class matter because we hadn't registered, we hadn't paid a fee, we didn't come out 4 times a year. I tried to argue we were first-class material, but it didn't quite. So that was, and that magazine had a life of its own. We tried to graduate it with us. The other thing in law school that meant a lot to me was I had never taken a writing class, and you asked, you said you didn't go to journalism school. I didn't, but there was one course there taught by a great maverick professor named Fred Rodell called Law and Public Opinion, which was basically writing about the law for non-lawyers. Mm-hmm. And Fred was famous because he had written an article for the Virginia Law Review way back in the 30s called Farewell to Law Reviews, the first sentence of which was, there are two things wrong with all legal writing. One, its content, and two, its style. And he vowed never to write another footnote, and he didn't. And in his course, you weren't allowed to use legal terms. So you had to, if you're talking about due process, you had to explain what you meant. Mm-hmm. And it was an invaluable discipline.
We're speaking this morning with Victor Novosky, author of A Matter of Opinion, former editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. Victor will speak this evening at the Multnomah Athletic Club in a speech sponsored by the World Affairs Council. It is 8:01 and you are listening to KBOO Portland. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. If you have a question or comment for Victor, please give us a call. And again, our numbers are 503-231-8187. You mentioned Monaco, the magazine that you started while in law school.
Yes.
And it was describe the magazine, was political satire?
Yeah. It was a magazine of political satire, and it had an odd shape. We used to call it as tall as Time and as wide as Reader's Digest. Now, our theory was that way, if we got a one-column Time magazine ad in our magazine, it would be a half-page in Monocle. If we got a full-page Digest, it would be three-quarter size. Of course, we didn't get any ads from any of those people. It was designed, we were in New Haven, so we got the students from the Graduate School of Design, who are brilliant designers and became the leading art directors in America and in the magazine world, to design us for credit. And we got, so we started it there. And we ran things in this, magazine, I mentioned before, it was during the end of the McCarthy period that the magazine started. We're in 1956. And we did things like we took the poem at the base of the Statue of Liberty, you know, Emma Lazarus's poem, Give Us Your Tired, Your Poor, Your Huddled Masses Yearning to Breathe Free, and we footnoted it with the McCarran-Walter Immigration Act. So that it read as follows. Give me your tired. And then the footnote says, unless they are aliens who are polygamists or who practice polygamy or who advocate for the practice of polygamy. You're poor. And then the footnote says, unless they are aliens who are paupers, professional beggars or vagrants, and or your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. Footnote, unless they are aliens who are afflicted with tuberculosis in any form. So all of the ironies of that glorious sort of message at the bottom of the Statue of Liberty being canceled out by this repressive legislation were on one page. And we ran limericks on members of the Supreme Court, and so it was a lot of fun to put out. And when we graduated in 59, we attempted to take the magazine with us and turn it into a business.
Mm-hmm. And how successful were you?
Well, let me read you, this may be a little long, I don't know, but we were very successful in the spirit of the thing, but we ran out of money after a few years, although I should say, our last issue, we charged $7.50. We listed our subscription price as $7.50 for 10 issues or $5 for a lifetime subscription. So by some theory, we're still publishing. but we had a whole bunch of theories about the magazine world that were very interesting and taught, and I still kind of wish we were around to practice them. For example, we thought the ideal magazine shouldn't come out by moon cycles, which you have to do as second class mail every quarter, every month, whatever, but be like come out when you had something to say. Yes. Or come out like the UN police force when it's an emergency. And, in fact, we put out some emergency bulletins, and eventually we called ourselves a radical sporadical. We also thought the ideal magazine shouldn't charge the same price every month, that or every quarter or every whatever. that if one issue was worth $2.50, you charge that. If another issue was worth a quarter, you charge that. But, of course, it would be inconvenient for retailers and that way. So we experimented with all these kind of strange, wacky ideas.
One could say that they are strange and wacky ideas, and one can imagine that you weren't grounded in reality, or were you grounded in reality?
Oh, I think satire is a great form of social criticism.
Yeah.
And, in fact, to pay the bills at Monocle, we started doing books, and one of the books we did was a hoax called Report from Iron Mountain.
Yes.
And the premise of this book, we didn't do it under our own name, but the premise of it was that Jack Kennedy, had appointed a commission to study the transition from a wartime to a peacetime economy, and that the people who had done the study had concluded that the economy would collapse without the threat of war. So the report was suppressed. And what this book was the suppressed report.
Yes.
And it was written by the late Leonard Lewin as a brilliant parody of think tank ease, like the Rand Corporation, with all of these fancy words and everything. And it was listed in the Dial Press catalog, they were the publishers, and their editor-in-chief, by the way, was a man who has subsequently become famous as a novelist for his blend of fact and fiction, E.L. Doctorow.
Mm-hmm.
And he saw the beauty of this hoax as a way of raising the questions that we were trying to bring to public attention. And they didn't put it in the catalog as fiction. They put it in the catalog as nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
The result was the New York Times ran a front page story about it, because when their reporter called the White House to ask if it was real, by this time Johnson was president, they said, well, we'll have to check it and get back to you. And then they told him no comment. So they put on the front page that this was a possible hoax, or it was possibly a real report. And it's still taught to this day in colleges, and also the militia down some of these radical right military groups got a hold of it, and they insist that this was real. And Leonard Lewin, of course, wrote an article pointing out that he wrote it and he made it up, and he made it up in working with the folks at Monocle, and people like John Kenneth Galbraith and others were in on the plot. So we did a lot of serious satire.
Excellent. And that report took on a life of its own. You know,
absolutely.
You mentioned militia, and I'm sure it turns up in some of their activities or meetings. As
it does. To this day, you can see that.
We're speaking with Victor Navasky, author of A Matter of Opinion, which is a compelling review of his life and the world of writing and magazines. He'll speak this evening at the Multnomah Athletic Club, sponsored by the World Affairs Council. All numbers are 503-231-8187. If you have questions or comments for Victor, give us a call, and we'll continue our conversation around the state of publishing this day. But first, let's go to a caller who's been waiting. Good morning, caller. You're on the air.
Hi there. Good morning. Yeah, when the military right buys something as real, that's the ultimate compliment for satirists. And I do believe that satire is a godsend, and that we need it. And you know, I'm a fan of Paul Krasner for that reason.
Yes.
What I wanted to say though is when you were talking about when it was kind of fun to lambaste to hold up the ideas of the kooks on the fringe as we always saw them, the right wing fringe, as you showed in the parody of your poem Give Us Your Tired. But what about today? I mean, I was listening to you and thinking, well, when the idiots on the fringe end up taking control of the government and the House and the Congress, what do you do about that? I mean, is satire strong enough? Or, I mean, it's a crazy time. We're actually not allowing people out. We're actually policing the borders now. It's
Well, you know, way back in the 50s, 60s, Jules Pfeiffer, the great cartoonist, said that life had become too absurd to satirize. But it's never quite the case. At the Democratic Convention up in Boston last time around, they had a panel with all of the anchors from all of the major networks on it, talking about their job. And at the end of the, you know, they're no longer any of them with us. Brokaw retired, Rather got kicked out, and Jennings died.
Yeah.
But the moderator was Jim Lehrer from, the Nightly News Hour, and Judy Woodruff was on it. And some guy got up in the audience and he asked in the first question, why do young people today say they don't watch the Nightly News and they get their news from Jon Stewart? So all the panelists had the same answer. That's because they're too stupid. They don't understand the difference between satire and the real thing. And I'm sitting there thinking, hey, just a minute. They watch Jon Stewart because he's very funny, but they also watch him for another reason. That is that all of the anchors go through this ritual pretense of narrative neutrality as if they have no politics of their own, which turns people off, young or old.
Right.
Whereas Jon Stewart never says anything he doesn't believe because he is in the business of exposing hypocrisy.
Exactly.
So I do think that...
That's where you find truth.
Yes.
So that's where we find truth.
So I think satire is an eternal form of social criticism that will always be there. And then the question you raise is a key one. How do you do it in different periods of time? And especially at a period like now, where, as you say, back in the 50s, they talk about Herman Kahn thinking the unthinkable. Now they do the unthinkable.
Right. Well, I guess that's the answer I wanted to hear. That's good, because even though it is horrifying, it's not like you can't give up satire, because satire is still so powerful that they'll try to suppress it. So that's
right. And well, I join you in your enthusiasm for Paul Krasner, the editor of The Realist magazine of free thought, criticism, and satire.
Did you work with him at all?
We found ourselves on lots of panels together, and we did some things, but I never worked side by side with Paul, but I consider him a friend.
I don't see a whole lot of satire in the Nation.
You're right. We could do more. We do some, and Trillin used to write every third week column. Humor column, and then he switched to being what he calls our deadline poet. He writes a weekly verse, and so we've got that in there. And with all his complaining about being paid in the high two figures, he one week had the nerve to write a four-word poem. So, and we pay him $100 a poem, so it makes him the highest-paid poet in the country.
Are you going to be doing anything else here besides? I mean, I'm really glad that you're here, but I have to say, I don't think I've ever even been inside the Multnomah Athletic Club.
Well, go. I haven't either. That'll make two of us.
Okay, but that's it, right? You're not going to any bookstores or?
Yeah, I've got a whole schedule, and I'm doing signings at various bookstores, but come to the Multnomah Athletic Club. It'd be fun to see you there.
Great.
Thank you so much for your call.
Yeah, thanks.
It's a nice, ornate setting, you know. It looks nice. You watch. And we'll go to our next caller. Good morning, and thank you for waiting.
Oh, good morning. Hello, how are you? It's so good to hear someone from The Nation magazine, one of my favorite publications. See, would you call this tome a memoir? And also, did you the Harvard Lampoon, which became the National Lampoon, went completely under finally recently, and speaking of satire and so forth, but did you have any connections with the Harvard Lampoon or the National Lampoon?
Yeah. Let's see. First of all, it's a different kind of memoir, a matter of opinion. It's not, I don't talk about what was my inner life or my relationship with my lovely wife and marvelous children and all that. It's a professional memoir.
A career memoir.
It's not even a career. I talk about my life as an editor and as a writer. And that, yeah, and that's true. So here's the relationship I had with Harvard's various publications. When I was a student at the Yale Law School, I was visited by the editor of something called the Harvard Law Record. He was a young law student named Ralph Nader, who I mentioned earlier, wrote his first article for The Nation magazine. He read Monocle magazine that came out of Yale, and he wanted to meet the editor. We became friends, and he would come when we took Monocle to New York. He would call, and he would come to town and he would annually pick at the automobile show, and he would ask his friends, myself included, to come with a briefcase. And put on a suit and tie and stand in front and pick at the automobile show. And Nader, who, you know, the previous caller was asking about satire, Nader went to the former Soviet Union and throughout Eastern Europe for the Christian Science Monitor and wrote up the satire magazines that existed in all of these countries like Crocodile in the former Soviet Union. The thing is, they weren't allowed to criticize the government, but they would criticize the local bureaucracy, and it was very interesting. And he saw that as a form of ombudsman.
So that satire is kind of democracy building.
That's that went on there. So then I came to New York, and Monocle, as I mentioned, was running out of money, and there was a great printer in New York who was a radical printer. And he was a Monocle fan and we were talking about his printing Monocle, but Monocle ran out of money, and he said he had a friend he called one day who wanted to talk to me. Well, the friend was someone named Matty Simmons, who had bought the rights from the Harvard Lampoon to start something called the National Lampoon, and they were looking for an editor, and we spoke. It wasn't for me, but I then got to know the people who did that, and I got to know one step removed from Harvard, but nevertheless we're now lifelong friends, Chris Cerf, who was one of the editors. And Chris and I did a book called The Experts Speak: The Definitive Guide to Authoritative Misinformation. And it's a collection of experts since the beginning of time who are wrong in every field, a kind of Guinness Book of World Records of false expertise. And we claim, by the way, that we don't claim that the experts are always wrong. It's just in our research we couldn't find any who are right. We're ready to concede they're right as much as half the time. So
now we have a local publication that I hate to call it a poser, the Mercury, but it's the only equivalent we have of satire locally, and it's actually a lot of the satire is formulated out of Seattle. What's with this paucity of local satire? Is that a nationwide phenomenon? Is there a way to have a resurgence in local satire?
Well, I think that's the way it ought to happen. And where do I subscribe? But there is, you know, this paper called The Onion, which is pretty funny. Mm-hmm. And,
oh, yes.
Anyway.
It's pure satire.
Okay.
Thank you.
Right.
We're speaking this morning with... I almost said Norman Mailer. What was that about? Whoa.
Well, listen, when I was in college, I came to New York one weekend, and I was at a party in the Village, and all of a sudden the word got around that Norman Mailer had chained himself to a chair across town at some East Village party, and so there was a big exodus today. I was on the board of directors of PEN with Norman Mailer, and we had a good time together.
But actually, we're speaking with Victor Novasky, author of A Matter of Opinion, of The Nation magazine. Give us a call if you have a comment or question, 503-231-8187. And in your book, you mentioned, I think, around 78, when you one time thinking of owning, buying the Nation. But you mentioned there about looking at what was being written and what was being published, and that the media, the homogenization of the media, and this was like 30 years ago. We fast forward now. How have things changed or remained the same in terms of...
Well, Ben Bagdikian, who was a great reporter at the Washington Post and elsewhere, and he became the dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at Berkeley, wrote a book in 1980 called Media Monopoly.
Mm-hmm.
And in that book, he documented that something like 50 corporations dominated more than half of all of the media in this country. And I include in that radio, television, magazines, newspapers, books, the information world. The book was republished about, a new edition came out 7 years later. He revised it, and the number of corporations was down to 27. Mm-hmm. The Nation asked him to to update it yet again in the early, I think it was the 89, and he projected that by the end of the century it would be down to 5 or 6, and that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so with conglomeratization comes homogenization, Murdochization, Oprahfication. The media is in trouble, and the new media, which is very exciting.
Yeah.
In the short run, I think, in the long run, I think the new media is a great development.
Mm-hmm.
Because the interactivity that it makes possible, the low startup costs of getting your own voice out there are tremendously exciting and maybe revolutionary on the one hand. On the other hand, in the short run, they have speeded up the news cycle. They're not fact-checked. And there's been, I think, a degradation of the mainstream media that the new media have contributed to,
mm-hmm.
ironically. And there's now a contest for ownership even of some of the new media.
Right.
And that's very dangerous, because the great thing about the Internet and all that has been that it's been free. And we don't know what's going to happen there.
We're speaking with Victor Navasky, author of A Matter of Opinion. Our numbers are 503-231-8187. Give us a call while we remain independent, and we'll go to our next caller. Good morning, and thank you for waiting.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I just want to say that, you know, that I see satire as rhetoric. And I also see that satire, especially in this day and age, is really for the people that's running the country, because they're the only people really in a position to laugh at themselves. Nobody else out here is in a position to laugh. And I subscribe to my satire, and what I subscribe to is that sticks and stones may hurt my bones, but words will never hurt me. And so that's what I see satire as. I think that what we need today is, we don't need satire. I think what we need today is we need some real strategies on how to make things right out here. I'm not a person that subscribes a lot to rhetoric, you know, because in the final analysis, talk is cheap. I think what we need to be doing is we need to be strategizing, and we need to be dismantling a system that is so repressive that I just think it's ludicrous, man, to put out something that only the rich people gonna laugh at. What do you say about that?
Well, I think it's not a case of either or. I think that I agree with you that we need a strategy, we need a program, we need a vision of a better world, we need organization. But I think that satire can make its contribution, and social criticism is necessary, and it's not just for rich people. Historically, some of the great satire is not rhetoric, it's cartoons, and I can tell you at The Nation, only twice in the whole time that I was editor did the staff march on me in advance and demand that something not be published, and in both cases it was a cartoon rather than words. And the great Art Young, way back at the turn of the last century, did a a cartoon showing Jesus Christ. It was a wanted for vagrancy poster. It said as much as any rhetoric or words could possibly say, and it was a form of social protest leading to action. I think it's a mistake to, I think you're right. It's a form of rhetoric, but it's a mistake to dismiss it as something that's class defined and that's irrelevant to the circumstance. And, if people laugh at themselves, that's all to the good. But satire can be very wounding, and, and it's hard for people who are satirized sometimes to take it.
Well, you know, that may be true, but I still see, let's take the Mac Club, for instance. You're going to the Mac Club. Well, the Mac Club is really, that's a snobby.
I've never been there.
Yeah,
I've
been there.
Wait till you've been there.
I've been there.
Okay. Well, can we undermine it? Can we change it? Can we talk to them?
but you might be able to go in there. I'm sure they're going to laugh at you. I'm sure they're going to, you know, the people that are members there, but it's not a place where the grassroots community congregate.
Right.
And
well, yeah.
That's all I'm saying.
Look, let me just say something about that. I'm grateful to be invited there. In my book, they have a bunch of quotes on the back, and my favorite one is from Bill Moyers, who claims that I am what he calls a subversive patriot. Mm-hmm. Now, I think that you want to speak to any time a mainstream organization invites me mm-hmm. to come and talk, I leap at the chance because, it would be, prideful to say that I'm going to subvert them. I don't think I have that power on the one hand. On the other hand, you shouldn't only talk to people who agree with you. You want to talk to people who have questions. And, at The Nation, for example, we do hundreds of events mm-hmm. a year where we don't charge a penny. And then we have a very elite dinner where we charge $500 a table, $1,000 a table, because we're raising money. Yeah. You do both those things. And everybody doesn't have to do them, but I think it's short-sighted to criticize people who try to have a conversation beyond their own community.
I understand that. And keep up the fight.
Thank you.
Talk to you later.
Okay. Thank you. We're speaking with Victor Navasky of A Matter of Opinion, who speaks in places all over the world. And we have a couple of callers, so we'll just continue with them. Good morning, caller. Thank you for waiting.
Oh, well. Sure. Good morning.
Good morning.
I've been voicing some complaint about campaign finance reform in our political arena and arguing that media reform has to occur at least at the same time, because if you have to pay for advertisements to get over the air to compete with voices over the radio and through the television and newspapers that are constantly and have this advantage that no matter what you pay, you don't have control over the debate. And so I always say that we need neither right radio, wing radio, or left wing talk shows, as much as we need moderate views presented fairly in the same venue. You know, not just right wing, because the people who are loyal right wingers will go to that radio and only listen to that speaker and be affected by those views, and left wing people will go to the left wing radios and only hear those views. And that's just, I think that's wrong.
Listen, in the current issue of The Nation magazine, there is a pull-out centerfold that documents media conglomeratization and concentration. Mm-hmm. But on the back of it is a list of 10, a program of 10 planks for media democracy. And
media reform.
Media reform and how to achieve media democracy. And Bob McChesney and John Nichols have been working on this and writing intermittently for, in Nichols' case regularly, and in McChesney's case intermittently for the magazine. And you might want to get a hold of that because it speaks directly to your point.
Well, I feel like as a moderate, I try to find some common ground, mm-hmm. and that it's like climbing up on a concrete barrier that's dividing left and right and becoming a target for both sides.
Well, you know, Jim Hightower says it's not left-right, it's top-bottom. And there are more of us at the bottom. And you got to join in. So.
All right. What time is your thing tonight at the Mac Club?
It's at 7 p.m. at the Mac Club.
All right. All right, well, have a good time in Portland.
Okay, maybe I'll see you there.
Well, stay cool.
We'll immoderate you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, this is just off. Speaking of campaign finance reform, the Supreme Court ruled Monday that the Vermont's limits on contribution and spending in political campaigns are too low and improperly hinder the ability of candidates to raise money and speak to voters. In a fractured set of opinions, justices said that they were sweeping aside 30 years of election finance precedent. They were not sweeping aside 30 years of election finance precedent, but rather finding only that Vermont's law, the strictest in the nation, sets limits that unconstitutionally hamstring candidates. The majority took issue with Vermont legislators for, quote, constraining speech, end of quote, by telling candidates and voters how much campaign was enough. President's two appointees sided with the majority in overturning Vermont's law. In one of six separate opinions, Justice Stephen Breyer said a majority of justices found Vermont law was unconstitutional. That is to say, they imposed burden upon First Amendment interests that, when viewed in light of the statute's legitimate objectives, are disproportionately severe, Breyer wrote. In 1997, Vermont passed its campaign finance law, placing a $300,000 spending cap on gubernatorial candidates and lesser limits for other state political contests. Contributions to state campaigns were limited to as little as $200 per election cycle for state House races, and that's from the AP.
You know, without having read those decisions, those opinions, it's impossible to really comment on that. Mm-hmm. News item, but it does touch on a critical issue. And how do you have fair elections if rich people can buy them?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer, among other things, is public financing of campaigns. So then you don't have to get into the free speech issue, mm-hmm. of saying some people aren't allowed to support who they want to the full extent of their ability, because money talks.
Right. Well, here in Portland, we just had an election cycle for municipal, for city council. It was the first cycle. We call it voter-owned election, which was public finances of candidates to try to make it more equal with those who are privately financed.
Mm-hmm.
So it needs to be tweaked, but it's a move in that direction. We're speaking this morning with Victor Novosky, of the Nation magazine, author of A Matter of Opinion. Give us a call at 503-231-8187 if you have a question or comment. And speaking of media and media reform and media democracy, you mentioned earlier in terms of the new media, what type of... I got up this morning, went to the computer, and went to, like, my favorite blogs.
Right.
In terms of that. What type of controls or possibilities do you see with this new technology? Anyone can write anything at any time. How do we get a hold of this?
Here are the things that, among the things that I like about it. It's very hard in a totalitarian country, mm-hmm. to keep certain kinds of information out mm-hmm. and to keep ideas controlled. With this new, it makes it much harder with this new technology, so it opens things up. And that, you can't underestimate, or I don't underestimate the importance of that. The ability to get quick interactivity in the new media is something that is... it's a way of carrying on the national conversation. And, you know, for years there was a debate about the role of journalism. And the late Walter Lippmann thought it was like science, that journalists were like scientists and they'd go and pursue the truth. Whereas the philosopher John Dewey said, no, it's not that way. You should, because there isn't something as simple as the truth in answer to a lot of questions. Mm-hmm. And what the function of the journalist is to raise the right questions. And then you get into a conversation. And the more questions, appropriate questions you raise, the better understanding you get of the problem. Mm-hmm. And that the function of the journalist is to advance that national conversation. And it's, you know, the authority of the better argument is what the majority determines, and journalism has a critical role to play there. Well, the new media is a way of advancing that conversation to a very important degree. The problem, as I said earlier, is that when you speed up the news cycle in a way that prohibits the kind of careful investigation and in magazines, fact-checking, daily reportage, the kind of careful reporting that the best reporters have done down through the ages, that you degrade the news-gathering process itself.
We're speaking this morning with Victor Novosky of The Nation. He is the author of A Matter of Opinion. He'll speak this evening at the... my favorite place this evening is the Multnomah Athletic Club, sponsored by the Portland World Affairs Council, at 7 p.m. Our numbers are 503-231-8187, and we'll go to our next caller. Thank you for waiting. You're on the air. Good morning, caller.
Hi, good morning. My name is Dr. Jason Barker. I wanted to call in some hydration guidelines for all the listeners out there today.
Okay.
All right, so... good thing to know is your body weight in pounds, and then divide that in two, and that will equal the number of ounces of water one should have on a daily basis. Now, today, with it being a little bit hotter, even a little bit more than that is a good idea. So, for instance, a 150-pound person, it needs 75 ounces of water today. Other good ideas are avoiding soda, coffee, and tea. Those things will only make you thirstier. They'll dehydrate you. And, of course, alcohol is bad news on a hot day like today, too. That will really dehydrate you. So avoiding those things is a good idea, and getting enough water in.
But suppose I want a beer.
So hold it for next weekend
okay.
when it cools down.
Thanks, Doc.
Hey, you're welcome. Have a good afternoon.
Okay, you too.
Bye.
Okay, our numbers are 503-231-8187, and do we have a call? No, we don't have a call. And we're speaking with Victor Novosky, author of A Matter of Opinion, and of The Nation magazine. Let's talk in terms of, your book talks about in the 50s and McCarthy era, and oftentimes I remember in school looking at that as a very... terrible period.
Right.
Many people today say that we're living in terrible times. Are there any insights from the 50s, from that era that may be useful today as we look at the scene we're in?
Well, yeah, I think so. You know, there are two themes in American history. One is the theme of freedom and liberty and Thomas Jefferson and Tom Paine and, you know, all of the things that one is taught in civics class is the good side of the American, the Bill of Rights, the good side of the American tradition. The other is the theme of repression and intolerance. It's the dark side of the American legacy. It goes back to the alien and sedition laws and, you know, the internment of the Japanese during World War II, the roundup of radicals after World War I, and the McCarthy period. And what you find is a repeating pattern of, in the name of national safety or national security, we have to cut back on civil liberty. Mm-hmm. And every time we do it, 25 years later, 50 years later, the historians come along and say, well, that was terrible. Not just the historians. The same institutions, the American Civil Liberties Union, which is there to protect the rights of the unpopular during the McCarthy years, they kicked, before McCarthy arrived, but in the atmosphere that gave, helped give rise to McCarthy, they kicked Elizabeth Gurley Flynn off their board. She was, because she was a member of the Communist Party. Well, the Communist Party was a legal party in this country. And, so 50 years later, or less than 50, maybe 35, 40 years later, they posthumously restored her to the board. So there's a historian, David Brian Davis, who looked at all of looked at the history of this country and concluded that the counter-subversives, almost without exception, did more damage than those who were alleged to be the subversives that they were trying to disable. Mm-hmm. And today, the thing is that with this so-called war on terrorism, and I call it so-called because to me, it's not a war in the, wars are won or lost. You can't win the war on terrorism because, the so-called war on terrorism, because if Osama bin Laden were picked up tomorrow and Saddam Hussein is convicted and sentenced to death and executed the day after tomorrow, the day after that, there's going to be a new car bombing. So, it's something else. And so, but if you suspend civil liberties, the right to counsel, the right to a speedy trial, because of the so-called war on terrorism, what you're doing is you're suspending them indefinitely. It's perpetual suspension. And so what do we learn from the past? Well, one thing you learn is the importance of resisting unjust authority, and that it's possible to resist and prevail. I mean, I wrote a book on the Hollywood blacklist, naming names, and you see cases of people like Lillian Hellman and Pete Seeger of the Weavers and the great character actor Lionel Stander. And they, after the so-called Hollywood Ten, went to prison for refusing to answer the questions of the House Un-American Activities Committee. They were cited for contempt of Congress and convicted and served terms of 6 months to a year. These other folks refused to cooperate with the committee. They invoked a different amendment, a Fifth Amendment. But what was common to many of them is they resisted and prevailed. In other words, history recognized that they had done something on behalf of the rest of us and on behalf of free speech. And in some cases, not all, I have to say, some never made it back, but some cases like Ring Lardner Jr., who told the Un-American Activities Committee, "I can answer your questions, sir, but I'll hate myself in the morning." They in Lardner's case, he went on to write MASH after 15 years later. He got off the blacklist, and they became honored, whereas the people who went along, famous director Elia Kazan, who made great films, but he named names and he took an ad urging other people to do likewise. They thought no one would ever remember what they had done, and it's the one thing people can't forget. So to do the right thing is its own, can frequently turn out to be its own reward.
You mentioned the Hollywood Ten, and you mentioned the research you did around that. And there's one part in the book And you mentioned also the director, Eli Kazan, and I remember a few years ago when he was honored by Academy or something, there was that discussion whether or not people will stand up and cheer,
yes,
or whether they will be in silence. And there's one part in the book where I guess someone who did not speak, or someone who spoke, who said, well, we were all victims.
Right.
Then, and
Dalton Trumbo.
Response. Yeah.
Dalton Trumbo made a great speech, I think, a very generous speech. He was one of the Hollywood Ten. He went to prison.
Mm-hmm.
Many years later, he won the Laurel Award, which is a special award given to Hollywood writers of great distinction. And in that speech, he said, those of you who are too young to remember the Blacklist should study it, because there are many lessons to be learned. But when you do, don't look for heroes and villains, because there were only victims. All of us were victims. And that sparked the debate,
right, yeah,
about, you know, was the people who named the names equally victims with the people who were named. And I think the spirit in which Trumbo said it was, the people who named the names didn't want to do that. They were terrorized into doing that. That's his view later on. Mm-hmm. At the time, he wrote a book called The Time of the Toad,
right,
where he wasn't at all as charitable, mm-hmm, towards those folks. And that's what gave rise to the debate, you know, on the question of Elia Kazan, should he have been given this Oscar to commemorate his achievement in the motion picture business. The argument against it was that part of his contribution in his lifetime, it was a lifetime achievement award, was not just the films that he made, which were great films, but that he put people in that business out of work by cooperating with the committee. That was the argument against it. The argument for it was, look, this is recognized as aesthetic achievement. It's not a political award. It's an aesthetic award. My own view was he should have been given the Oscar, but they should have printed the names on the back of it that he had named to remind him of what he did. What a matter.
His lifetime.
Yes.
We have a few callers online and not that much time, so let's try to get to our callers. Good morning, caller, and thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Yes, I'd like to know what you think about the difference between reporting and commentaries. And the particular example I have is the Wall Street Journal, that quite often the reporters actually contradict the editorial sort of commentaries that are on the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal.
Well, it's a wise observation. The Wall Street Journal, I think, has a great repertorial tradition, and its editorial page is a far right wing editorial page.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea that you can separate commentary from reporting that neatly is problematic. You know, in England, there's a lot more recognition of the importance of what they think of as interpretive, analytical reportage. And, you know, in this country, you know, the New York Times, for example, has something where they'll put a little box in saying news analysis, as though it's not the real news, it's something else. And the editorial page is a little bit of a ghetto. It's a little bit of a second-class citizen. And the president of ABC News goes around making a speech where he says that opinion is driving objectivity out of business. And I deal in a matter of opinion with the question of objectivity. And I think, obviously, there's the opinion, ideas, analysis, advocacy, that's what democracy is all about. Objectivity, I think it's an illusion to think that you can have objectivity. Molly Ivins, I quote her in A Matter of Opinion, where she says, look, I'm a 49-year-old white, college-educated Texas woman, and there's no way in hell that I'm going to see things the same way as a 15-year-old black high school dropout. And anyone who was covered and talked to five witnesses to an automobile accident knows there's no such thing as objectivity. That doesn't mean you don't try to get the facts right. That doesn't mean you leave out inconvenient information. That doesn't mean you stack the deck when you report a story. But the interplay between editorial page and the rest of the paper is worth studying, thinking about, and observing.
Thank you for that call. And we'll go to our next caller. Good morning, caller. Thank you for waiting.
Good morning, and welcome to Portland. Given the homogenization of the media by ownership of maybe a half a dozen now, what is the role of the media going to be as the fourth estate in this century? I mean, is there going to be... I go back to the time when they actually did serve a function as sort of a fourth check and balance to the whole process. I'd like your thoughts on that. Thanks.
Well, you know, you're talking to someone who thought Adlai Stevenson was going to be president, so I'm not a great prophet or prognosticator. But I'm an optimist about it. I think that it's given rise to, this concentration has given rise to a lot of independent, small publications, and the Pacifica radio movement is out there. There is an organization called the Independent Press Association that's based in San Francisco that has hundreds of members. Eventually it's going to be thousands, and they're small independent voices. So number one, you do what you can to encourage independent voices. You can do this, by the way, through legislation as well as citizen action, through postal subsidies to smaller journals, through the allocation of frequencies in the FCC and other things. But you've got to put pressure on those, the citizen pressure, on administratively and legislatively to help open up these alternative channels of communication. There's another thing that seems to be happening. This is on the bright side, but you have to, I think it has to become a political issue for media democracy to be a reality. But another thing that's happening internally is a lot of these huge organizations, Time Warner, for example, AOL Time Warner, are breaking up from inside, and they're deaccessioning properties that they had acquired before. It doesn't, the so-called synergy doesn't seem to work. So it may be that there is some natural law at work there that will keep the concentration from happening the way that you're worried about.
Well, we hope so. And Adlai Stevenson wasn't elected in 1956?
Not as president.
Oh, not as president. But John Kerry,
his son was elected senator.
Senator. Okay. Let's go to our next caller. Good morning.
Oh, yes, is that me?
Yes, it is.
Thank you. Thank you so much for taking my call, and I won't take long. But I'm just wondering if the war on terrorism isn't just much like the war on drugs. It was created to steal money from the masses, and now we can steal more money from the masses through taxes to fight these wars. Just a thought.
Uh-huh.
But thanks anyway. Bye-bye.
Well, I think they're both... I don't quite agree. I don't think it was created to steal money, but I think they're both ill-chosen metaphors, and they're both misguided ventures, the way they are being, I'll put it in quotes, fought.
Mm-hmm. And let's see if we can get our last caller in. Good morning, caller. Thank you for waiting.
Hello?
Yes, that's you.
Okay. Here's my question. I mean, we're talking about the Hollywood 10 and other people like that. Wasn't it, I mean, not only were people put out of work, some people committed suicide, I believe, and other, of course, a lot of people simply left the country. I know some of those because I'm, you know, I'm old enough to know. And also, to be specific, wasn't it Burl Ives that told on his friend Pete Seeger? He may have done it because he was scared, but I thought that I heard that was true. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
There was a lot of betrayal in that period, and You're right. I mean, there was a television actor, Phil Loeb, who jumped out a window, and the movie The Front is based on that episode, written by Woody Allen and starring a whole bunch of blacklisted, and excuse me, written by Walter Bernstein. Woody Allen was in it, and Walter Bernstein was a blacklisted screenwriter, and it starred a whole bunch of blacklisted actors, including Zero Mostel, who, by the way, was a great uncooperative witness. He was asked by the chairman of the committee, "Didn't you perform before a Communist Party cell, such and such?" And Mostel said, who was, you know, looked like a walrus and was, he said, "All I did was imitate a butterfly at rest." And the chairman of the committee said, but by imitating a butterfly at rest, you were putting money in the coffers of the Communist Party. Can't you do your imitation of a butterfly at rest before a good American organization like the American Legion or something?" And Mostel said, "There aren't that many people interested in seeing an imitation of a butterfly at rest." So there are ways of using humor and ridicule to make your point, even in the awful situation of the blacklist. Yes, a lot of people went overseas. Carl Foreman, Michael Wilson, who wrote Bridge on the River Kwai under pseudonyms, and it was a devastating period, and Berlaz did not behave well.
We've been speaking this morning with Victor Novasky, author of A Matter of Opinion, of the Nation magazine, a magazine that's been around on the cutting edge for almost a century and a half now. Victor will speak this evening. The World Affairs Council is sponsoring a lecture at 7 p.m. at the Multnomah Athletic Club, 1849 Southwest Salmon, at 7 p.m. For reservations or for tickets, call 503-274-7488. And before we have you go, perhaps we can end by you stating, what are some things, signs of hope, things that inspire you?
Oh, boy. Well, you know, we had all these calls about and conversation about the Internet, and you have organizations like MoveOn.com, mm-hmm. which is organized by young people, some of them in their 20s, and they have broken the cycle of money and big money influencing politics to the extent that using the new technology, they have shown that there are people out there, hundreds of thousands, millions of people, who will send money in small amounts to support causes and candidates that they care about. And that could be a dramatic cause a dramatic change in the political chemistry of the company, of the country, and the political culture. You know, I came to the Nation in 1978. We had 20,000 paying readers. We now have about 200,000 subscribers to this magazine, and more, by the way, than any other magazine in that category of weekly journals of opinion, biweeklies. Mm-hmm. The Nation has now passed National Review. Oh. Bill Buckley's old conservative magazine, which is always the leader. Mm-hmm. The New Republic, the Weekly Standard, which is owned by Rupert Murdoch. Well, that's a cause for optimism for me.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Please, if you haven't, pick up a copy of the book, A Matter of Opinion. It's a great read. I found it excellent and inspiring. Victor, thank you for your work and for joining us here.
Thank you for having this stimulating conversation, Sister.
Well, thank you so much. Stay tuned for the OMO Variety Hour, Health Watch, Earth Watch, and at 11, Democracy Now!, stay tuned to KBOO, your community radio station. Have a great day and stay cool.
Good morning. It's 9... Oh, no, it's almost 9:01. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. Welcome to the Radio Zine for Monday the 26th. Coming right up on KBOO, it's the Old Mole Variety Hour. Today, Bill Resnick's going to interview Kathleen Walsh of Portland City Repair Project and other great interviews and discussions today on Old Mole Variety Hour. At 10 o'clock on Health Watch, Dr. David Naiman speaks with Hensie Goer, author of The Thinking Woman's Guide to a Better Birth. And at 10:30 on Earthwatch, the guest is Elizabeth Colbert, author of Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change. And at 11 o'clock on Democracy Now! Here, a defense attorney and community advocate involved in the case of seven men arrested in Miami last week on charges of conspiring to blow up the Sears Tower. Also, immigrants' rights activist Nativo Lopez speaks the future of the Senate immigration bill. And war, peace, racism, and the World Cup. Here comes the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO.